We are on page 754. 2 weeks ago, we started the concept of a saita. A saita, like we learned, is a husband suspects his wife of being with somebody. He warns her in front of two witnesses, basically, according to one opinion in the Mishnah. And he says, I don't want you to be secluded with this and this guy. And she goes ahead and does it anyway. Now, there's witnesses that she was secluded with the guy, but there's no witnesses that anything happened with the guy. Okay? That's primarily the case of the saita where the husband has to bring the wife to the kohen, and the procedure is done. She's innocent, it's good. If she's guilty, it's not good. And as we learned 3 weeks ago, it was that what's the connection between before we learned about giving the gifts to the kohen? The Torah says if you're not going to bring the gifts to the kohen, you're going to have to bring your wife to the kohen. You're going to have to end up by the kohen anyway. You might as well end up for good things, bringing him truma and meiser and the tithes and all that, rather than bringing the wife. We also discussed last time, just to refresh the memory before we go further, we learned also that the concept of saita comes from the word shtus. We learned shtus is turning. Like Rashi says, tot midarke hatznius, she turned away from the way of modesty. And like we learned, there's a middle of the road path. Any turning higher or lower is called shtus. In this case, it's below normal. The woman committed this crime. So she did a shtus. And as we explained last time, the concept of the shtus is that really every sin, no matter what it is idol worshipping, because you're denying the existence of God. In God's presence, you have the chutzpah to go sin. So therefore, any sin is really idol worshipping. But we think that, you know, I'm still connected. You know, bowing down to an idol, I understand, they disconnect. But if I'm not bowing down to an idol, I'm not keeping Shabbos, kosher, whatever the mitzvah may be, big deal, I'm still connected. And that's the shtus, the foolishness, because the truth is, everything, no matter what it is idol worshipping. This is, I think, basically what we discussed last time. Now, the Gemara says over here, the Gemara says over here that basically this law of the Saita is actually transgressing all 10 commandments of the Torah. Okay? And that's the way, like this. And the Gemara says like this. A woman who commits, or a man who commits adultery with a married woman is transgressing all 10 commandments. Okay? And they enumerate like this. God, I am God, your God. He's not listening to God. He's not listening to God. Obviously, he's sinning. God says you should not have any other gods. Committing adultery is like another god, right? Like the wedding between Hashem and the Jews, having is like having another wife. The third one is...
But he could have another wife.
Huh? But he could we're speaking about the woman who commits adultery. She can't. Right. I mean, or... No, if a man commits adultery with a married woman, I mean, they're both guilty. Okay. And then it says, okay, you're transgressing not having a God. When they want to get punished, you know, the woman or the man swear I didn't do it. So they're transgressing the third one of the Ten Commandments, not to swear falsely. The next one is honor your father and mother. Because when you commit adultery, then you don't end up knowing who's the father, who's the mother anymore. Right? Like when you ask somebody who's your father, five people raise their hands. Because you don't know who's the real father of this person. And in fact, they asked Rav Huna, okay, I understand, but how's the desecration of Shabbos? So he says, it could happen. If there was a wife of a Kohen, and somebody committed adultery with her, and she gives birth to a son, everybody thinks he's a Kohen, when he's not, when he's a mamzer, and then he'll work on the Mizbeach on Shabbos, and he'll be desecrating Shabbos. Okay? Then obviously, stealing it is, murder it is, because you're killing a family, and it's desiring. Basically, the Gemara says, you're transgressing all 10 commandments when somebody commits adultery, even the concept of Shabbos.
Okay? But there's no witnesses.
Witnesses of what?
Of the adultery. So.
No. If there's witnesses of adultery, then the Saita didn't drink the water. Then she got killed. In this case, even if, because the Torah, we'll soon see the expression of the Torah, it says, Ve'ed ein ba. Okay, we'll see it inside. But the din is over here, one witness would also put her to death in this case. Only in this case. Even though one witness normally doesn't put to death. In this case, it would. We'll see in a few things. What? No, it has to be male. In this case. Women, one second. There's, when it comes to punishment, you need two witnesses. In this case, because the husband warned the woman already in front of two witnesses. That means he's already suspecting the wife, and the husband's warning her in front of two witnesses, I don't want you to be alone with this and this man. So if one witness testifies that they committed adultery, then they would kill him. Her and him. In that case.
Either way. If it's her and him.
Right. The woman and the man. Then. Right. But normally, one witness in halacha is not allowed when it comes to punishment. But one witness can establish kosher and non-kosher. Okay? And under those circumstances, women and men can testify.
Under kosher and non-kosher.
Right. And things, I'll give you an example. A guy comes home, his wife made him dinner. Yeah? How did he know it's kosher?
Trust her.
That's the baby.
No, really. How do you know it's kosher? Because the wife says it's kosher. But she's a woman now. How do you have a hashgacha? Basically, like a mashgir, right? The answer is, says in halacha, Eid echod nemen be'isurin. When it comes to isur and heter, meaning kosher and treif, or a woman by Nida is believed that she went to the mikvah and that she counted and she did everything properly. How do we know she did it? Because she said she did it, so she's believed. She's one witness and not a kosher witness, she's a woman. The answer is, in Isur and Heter, it's believed. Now, let's say there's something called chelev. Chelev is trait for fats of an animal, that if you eat it, you get whipped. Okay? What happens if one witness says, this is chelev? We don't know. One witness comes and says, this is the treif of fats. And then two other people testify that they saw the guy eat it. They didn't know that it was treif. Okay? They just saw the guy eat it. Who made this treif? One witness made a treif by saying it's treif. Right? In that case, he believed like two that it's treif. And then when two witnesses testify that this guy ate this thing, whatever this is, he would get whipped. Because...
If he was warned, or...
Obviously warned, yeah. I mean, if he was warned to witnesses, and they told him the punishment is... So, normally, one witness is not believed when it comes to punishment. In other words, if you know something is treif, and one witness testified that he ate it, then he wouldn't get whipped. Actually, one witness can only extract a vow from a person. If one person tested, and this is important why I'm discussing this, because we'll see it in the Saita, then it's important to understand the one witness, the two witnesses thing. If one witness witnessed a murder, you don't do anything to the guy. Okay, one witness is not believed as a witness. The only thing one witness could do is extract an oath, and if a biblical oath, by the way, and if you can't swear, then you have to pay. For instance, if I come over to you and say, I lent you $1,000, you owe me $1,000. You deny it. Okay? And I bring two witnesses that you owe me $1,000, you have to pay me $1,000. What happens if I have no witnesses? I say, no documents, no witness, nothing. I say, you owe me $1,000. You say, go fly a kite. I don't know your thing. Okay? You don't have to pay me. There's a rabbinic oath, but you don't have to... What happens if I say, you owe me $1,000? You deny it. and I have one witness that you owe me $1,000. Not two. Two would make him pay. Right? No witnesses would make nothing. I have one witness called Eid Echad. One witness that you owe me $1,000. What's the halacha? What does the Torah say you have to do? You have to swear that you don't. You have to swear against the testimony of the one witness. If there's two witnesses, you can swear from today till tomorrow, you are not believed. Two witnesses is it. If there's one witness, if there's one witness, you don't have to pay me. The Torah says, you have to swear against the testimony of the witness, and then you're believed. What happens if you can't swear? For instance, the witness says, you owe me $1,000, one witness. And you say, I don't know. You can't swear. Yeah, you can't swear, because what you have to swear is against the testimony of the witness. The witness says you owe. You can't say, I don't know. That's not against the testimony of the witness. If you say, I don't owe you, that's against the testimony of the witness. That's what you can swear. You have to swear against the testimony of the witness. What happens in this case? You can't. So then you have to pay. But in other words, the one witness doesn't extract payment, he extracts a vow. The Gemara is a famous Gemara in Bava Basra, it's called Naschad Rababa. Over there was a story like this. I went into your house and took your silver Kiddush cup. Okay? You come and say, why did you take my cup? If I said I didn't take it, prove it. Okay? You bring one witness that I took the cup. What do I say? Yeah, I took the cup from your house, but it's mine. I took the cup from your house, but it's mine. Now, what's the one witness saying? That I took the cup. That's all you're saying. What would I have to swear? That I didn't take the cup. I can't swear I didn't take the cup because I'm saying I did take the cup, but it was mine. So that I can't swear against the witness, so I have to give it back. What?
I was going to say, if the Edim needs to swear as well, just because...
No, the Edim never swear.
So if two people make a plot, they come against this guy...
Yeah, but Bezin checks out the witnesses. I mean, they don't play games. They check them out, make sure that they're right.
So what if you have your own witnesses to say that you didn't?
Right.
He's got two, I've got two.
Right.
They cancel each other out. They cancel it. We're going off the topic. They cancel each other out, and there are no witnesses. It's called hakchasha. Unless if it's Edim Zeimimin, then you always believe the second group of witnesses. But hakchasha is, I owe you, no you don't, I have two, you have two. They're non-existent. They cancel each other out, non-existent.
Yeah.
What?
Two non-observers.
Yeah.
Commit adultery. Both of them.
No, no, I took it. What?
Both of them.
Him and her.
The woman commits adultery and the man commits it.
No.
There's no witnesses and they don't care. There's no witnesses.
They're married to each other?
Huh?
They're married to each other?
No, they're married to what? A woman is married and a man is married.
Right.
And they commit adultery.
It happens, yeah.
Yeah. In the secular world, it happens a lot.
Yeah.
But there's no witnesses, and they don't care. And then, 5 years later, one or both of them does tshuva. Is there a punishment?
Well, we're going to learn later. There's a concept called asura labal v'asura labayil. A married woman who commits adultery, and the husband finds out about it, okay, cannot stay married to the husband, and she cannot stay married to the guy she had relations with. I mean, get married. That's if the husband believes it. Or not.
The husband doesn't find out about it.
Then he doesn't know. He doesn't know. Ignorance is bliss. But
you took the cup and you say it is your cup.
Right.
Can you bring two witnesses that it is indeed your cup?
If I bring two witnesses, that's my cup, then I don't swear. If you bring one witness, I owe you money. And I bring two that I don't swear. I don't have to pay. Okay, anyway, let's go back to say it. Okay.
So
in this stuff.
There is some place I saw a woman, she is the mashkiach. Is possible?
Halachically, there could be a mashkiach. That's a different story, but I'm saying. And if a man's not from, he also can be a mashkiach. Okay, let's go back to him.
So the penalty for the woman if she cheated and she can't, the husband divorces her and she can't marry the guy.
Right.
What if the husband cheated? Okay, is the rule the same?
Married,
he has to divorce his wife and he can't be with the woman that he cheated with?
No, because technically he committed adultery, he would get stoned in the time of the Beis HaMikdash. But in this case, because he's technically allowed to have many wives, there's not adultery with that. I know. Okay. Let's move on. Okay. So all the way on top of the page. Martalem say to the Jews like this. Ish ki sister ishtay. If a man will... Ish, okay? Any man, and Rashi says it means the man above God and the man below down here. Kisiste ishtei, if he will, the wife will go astray, umala b'imal, and she commits treachery against the husband, okay? B'shachav ish aisa shichva zedah. And what really happened was that the second guy did live with her. I mean, had relations with her. V'nala me'ene isha, and it's concealed from the eyes of the husband, and she was concealed, hid from the secluded from the husband, and she taka became tamei. Now the scenario over here is the husband warned her, "Don't be with this guy," and she secluded with the guy, and she became, she defiled. She lived with him, but the aid ain't ba. There's no witness to testify. V'hilein nispasa. And it wasn't been forced. Because the din is like this. God forbid, if a married woman, God forbid, is raped, so she doesn't become usher to the husband. Unless, if the husband's a kohen, then she's not allowed to stay married to the husband. God forbid, even if she's raped. But that's where the Torah says, the healing is possible, she wasn't forced. If she was forced, so then she didn't do anything wrong, and therefore, it's not forbidden to remain married to the husband. So, and this applies, by the way, even by a goy. And the proof of this is from Megillas Esther. According to one opinion, according to many opinions, Esther was married to Mordechai, and she was married to Achashverosh. One woman had two husbands, right? If you hold by Yilabas, that he married her,
does it count?
According to one opinion, Esther and Mordechai were married. She was taken forcibly to Achashverosh. Okay? So she never went willingly. So in fact, the Gemara asks, how is Esther allowed to do it? She was committing adultery. If she was married to Mordechai, she's committing adultery with a goy. Granted, if she becomes pregnant, the kid's not a mamzer, but it's still forbidden. So the Gemara answers the famous expression, Esther karka olam hava. Esther was like the ground, the earth. Meaning like this. There is, in adultery, there's the active, which is the man, and there's the passive, which is the woman. So if a woman is willingly doing it, then she's not passive. She's also active. If, God forbid, she's forced, then the Gemara says she's like the ground. I mean, you know, she didn't do anything wrong. So the whole time, Esther didn't want to be with Achashverosh. And therefore, she was not forbidden from Mordechai. Because basically she was like similar to the concept of being raped. When Mordechai said to her, go to the king, and she said, how can I go? I'm not called 30 days. And she said, oh, Mordechai said, stop playing games, go. And so Esther said 3 days of, 72 hours. What did she have to say afterwards? Kasher avadati, avadati. I will be lost, lost. So what's the double expression? So, according to one halach is that she couldn't stay married to Mordechai anymore, because now she willingly went to Achashverosh. Lepel, nothing ever happened between them, except she invited him to the party. Right? So it's lavdafka that she actually was intimate with Achashverosh at that time. But she said, if that's what it's going to take, avadati, avadati, double expression, I'm lost in this world and in the world to come. Because he might kill me, Achashverosh, and even if he doesn't kill me, then I'm lost to Mordechai and Olam Haba for doing it. Abinabel, it seems from the Megillah that nothing did happen between Achashverosh and Esther in the intimate relations. But it says, therefore it says, V'hilo in his pasuk, it's a very important din. Because if she was forced, raped, God forbid, then this din of Saita doesn't apply. Or, like we said, the concept of Asura Labal, Asura Labal, that she's forbidden for the husband and for the guy she lived with, that wouldn't apply, God forbid, if a woman is forced. Now, there's an interesting thing. The Rebbe writes in a Sikha, just an interesting concept. This concept of Seita exists really between Hashem and the Jews. Okay? What did Hashem warn the Jews? You shouldn't have any other gods. That means, don't go there. Right? He warned her. Like Seita. Okay? What happens? So the Rebbe asks the Sikha, but how can a person hide from Hashem? The whole concept of Seita is she became secluded, but how can somebody hide from Hashem? So the Gemara answers, so the Rebbe says in the Sikha, this is what the Gemara says. The Gemara says at the beginning of Seita about arrogance and haughtiness, Hashem says, Ein ani v'hu yecholim ladur. The beginning of the Gemara says there's like 3 pages. The Gemara knocks haughtiness and ego, how bad it is. Mamash, 3 pages straight. It's like worshipping idols and this and that and everything under the sun. So over there, the Gemara says about a haughty person that Hashem says, "Ein ani v'hu yecholim ladur." I cannot coexist with him. So the Rebbe explains this is how you become secluded from. How can you hide from Hashem if Hashem's all over? How can you hide from Hashem? The answer is, if you're arrogant, Hashem says, I can't be where you are. So then you can seclude. And then you have the concept of a Saita. And in fact, it says in the Medrash, the Farshim over here bring down, that the Egyptians were mocking the Jews, that all the women in Egypt committed adultery with the Egyptians. That's what the Medrash said. The Egyptian men, or the Egyptians were saying, you think the Jewish women are so innocent, they fooled around with every Egyptian man. So it says Hashem gave them the sight of the waters, and they all came out with flying colors, innocent. But you have this concept of sight even between a Jew and Hashem. Hashem warns us, don't have any other gods, meaning don't sin and don't everything. How can you be secluded? The only case is when a person has a lot of arrogance. Okay. What?
Why a child from Achashverosh and Esther is not a mamzer?
Because from a guy, it's not a mamzer. If a guy commits adultery with a Jewish woman who's married, right, and she gets pregnant, the kid's not a mamzer.
So what is it? It's just another Jew?
Another Jew. Like all other Jews. A non-mamzer Jew. If it's a Jewish man, the kid would be a mamzer. But as far as being forbidden to the husband, that would be anyway. Except the kid's not a mamzer.
So the rules about the marriage would still apply. That she could not, he would have to divorce her.
Right. Huh?
And did he divorce her? Was it more tight?
Okay, anyway. Let's go. Va'avar olav ruach kina, and then what happened was pasuk yudalid. Va'avar olav ruach kina, spirit of jealousy passed over him. The kines ishtay, and he warned his wife. He nitman, she did become tummy. Ara alav ruachin, or a jealousy spirit came over him, and he warned his wife, but she wasn't tameya. You know, the Torah says, basically, we don't know, because there's no witnesses. We just know that she was secluded with the guy. He warned her, don't be with this guy. She ended up being secluded with this guy, but we don't know if she's innocent, tohara, or tameya. We don't know what she did. So what do you do? So the Torah says, behavi ha'ish esishtei al ha'kayin. You bring in the man and the woman to the kayin. The man brings his wife to the kayin. Behavi is karban aleha, and she brings a sacrifice for her. Asira so eifa kemach sa'idim, tenth of a eifa of a barley flour. Layitzek aleha shemen, you should not pour oil over it. Normally, the flour offerings in the Beis HaMikdash, this is unique. The flour offerings in the Beis HaMikdash were number one from wheat, not from barley. Secondly, everyone had spice on it, levaina and shemen. This one, the Torah says, no. Number one is from barley, kemach sa'edim, barley. And no oil, no, you should not put the spice on it, because kiminchas kenoyes hu, it's a meal offering of jealousness, a meal offering of remembrance, maskeres oven, remainder of a sin. In other words, like this, the Gemara says, believe it or not, the Gemara says, wheat is ma'achal odom. Barley, ma'achal behemah. So I guess we're all behemoths because we eat barley in the Choland. Now, wheat is a person's food. Barley, the Gemara says, Sa'edim is Michael Behem. The animals will be given barley. So over here, the Gemara says, why, I think it's Rabbi Gamliel says, why over here does the woman bring a flour offering out of barley? Because she acted like an animal? So let her carbon bring an animal. Animal food. Normally you spice up the flour offering with oil and the spice. Hers has to be plain. No spice up, you know. Keep it plain and simple because she committed an act of adultery. Or, we don't know yet.
She's accused.
But this test, it's interesting, Mefoshim say, this is the only halacha that Hashem deals with the supernatural. This is the only halacha where Hashem, which deals with this. Normally, there's no such thing as supernatural in halacha. Right? In fact, according to halacha, you cannot do a mitzvah with supernatural stuff. So one of the main questions in Chanukah is, how did they light the menorah with miracle oil when you're not allowed to, the Mefoshim asked, you're not allowed to use miracle things. How did they light the menorah with oil, miracle oil? And the answer wasn't miracle oil, it was this oil, that, whatever. But you can't do a miracle, a mitzvah with miracle. This is the only mitzvah of drinking the water that, you know, was from above, innocent, innocent, guilty, guilty. This is the only supernatural thing that works in halacha. Otherwise, it doesn't exist.
And pure and impure, you don't say it's supernatural?
No, I'm saying that the mitzvah is guided by the supernatural. So whether she's innocent or guilty is straight a miracle from Hashem. Normally you don't rule Bezdin, you know. In fact, there's a famous question asked in Chassidus when there's argument Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. Okay, usually Beis Hillel is lenient, Beis Shammai is stricter. Okay? So it says in Kabbalah, why? So that is alright, because Beis Hillel's neshamas came from Chesed, and Beis Shammai's neshamas came from Gevurah. So Beis Hillel Chesed is lenient, and Beis Shammai is Gevurah, so the stricter. So Chassidus says, but Torah lei b'shamayim hi. Even if a voice, in the famous argument in Rebbetzin and Beshua, Rabbi Lazar, who's right, and a voice came out from heaven, he says, you're right, and he says, ei meshgichem b'vaskel, it doesn't matter what the voice from heaven says, because Torah is not in the heaven. Yeah? It doesn't matter. God can scream from today till tomorrow. You're right. It doesn't mean anything. Because Torah is down here, lo b'shamayim. In this case, it's a bashamayim. Innocent or guilty is coming from Hashem. If she's guilty or not. I think I told last time the story about the two sisters that were identical, right? Okay, so even over there, it worked that the other one died just being near her sister. It's all supernatural stuff. Okay. The kohen brings it close. Okay. The kohen brings it closer, and he brings it before Hashem. The lokach hakohen ma'im kadoshim b'chlichores. The kohen takes holy water. Okay, he takes holy water from, and as the Gemara says, it was from the kiyod. You know, from the sink in the base, the where the kohen washed their hands every day. That's where they took the water from. Umin ha'afa sheyir bekarka hamishkan. From the earth, which will be from the floor of the Mishkan, okay? In other words, they say like this. The Gemara says, in the Mishkan, they partially took it from the sand of the desert. In the Beis HaMikdash, there was a board, okay, that they picked it up, that had a handle on it, they picked it up, and they took dirt from underneath the Beis HaMikdash to mix with the water. And yikach hakayim v'nasin alamayim. The kohen would take it and put it in the water. Okay. Now Rashi comments on this over here like this: why if it's in a kli cheres? Kli cheres is a cheap earthenware vessel, right? In the Beis HaMikdash, everything was rich: gold, silver. Over here, she's like getting to drink in the even the animals. The Gemara, the Mishnah says, drank from golden utensils. And here, the site is drinking from cheap, so Rashi says, from the Gemara, she gave the adulterous man, when she was sinning with him, beautiful glasses and beautiful cups, you know. So therefore, she's punished to drink from cheap garbage. But there's many things over here that goes on that because, Rashi says, and this remarkable thing is in this week's parasha. What was the wash basin and the Beis HaMikdash made from? The women's mirrors. The women's mirrors. Okay? And in fact, it says, in Rashi quotes from the Medrash, that when the women brought their mirrors, which basically women beautify themselves with mirrors, right? They brought them to Moshe Rabbeinu as one of the donations to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Mishkan. Moshe Rabbeinu was very hesitant to take it. He said, this is made for Yetzer Hara. Physical beauty, yes. Hashem said, no. You have to 100% take it. Well, why? Hashem said, Rashi quotes in the Medrash, because the women in Mitzrayim would beautify themselves when the husbands came home after a full day of slavery and so on. The women beautified themselves, and that's how the Jewish population grew in Mitzrayim. So therefore, Hashem said to Moshe Rabbeinu, not only are you going to take it, the first thing the Kohanim do every day in the Beis HaMikdash is to wash their hands and feet from that. You know, not only are you using it in the Beis HaMikdash, it's the first thing on a daily basis that the Kohanim used was the sink to wash their hands. So it says that those mirrors, right, that were made for the purity of the Jewish people, to create, you know, the family purity and Mitzrayim of the Jewish people, that is where you're going to take the water for this woman that did this despicable thing. In other words, like deed for deed. She gave him expensive cup, he gave it to drink in this cheap cup. So we're going to learn, she beautifies himself, she make her look ugly. As we'll learn in the Psukim what the Kohen did to her.
This is even before she's proven guilty.
Right. That's why the humiliation that the woman, if she's innocent, the humiliation that she gets with all this, gives her that fabulous bracha. You know, if she had problems, she was easy and, you know, whatever. Okay. Behemid HaKoyin, the next pasuk is a very interesting pasuk. It's a source of something very important in Torah. Behemid HaKoyin is a isha lefnei Hashem. The Kohen would stand, would have the woman stand before Hashem, and Rashi says, Rashi asks, it says already before, you did it, brought it before Hashem. In Pasuk Tezayin it says, V'hemidah lefnei Hashem. And then again it says, Hemidah lefnei Hashem. So Rashi says also from the Gemara, they make the lady crazy that she should admit guilt. They made her go here and there and back and forth just to make her crazy. That she should be so tired, she should just, if she's guilty, she should just admit her guilt. Because then God's name wouldn't have to be erased. Anyway, so it says like this. You put the woman again lefnei Hashem. Upada Sresha Isha, you uncover the woman's head. V'nasin al-kapel, and on the, her palms of the hand you put minchas as you call it, minchas kenoisi, this a flower offering that she had, and the kohen would have the main modim and modim. Okay, before we go into the actual pasuk, this is the source, by the way, in Chumash, of a woman covering her hair, of a married woman covering her hair, is this pasuk, because it says by the seita the kohen uncovers her hair, which means that the hair was always covered. Okay? If the hair was always covered, so the kohen uncovered. This is the biblical source, by the way, of the whole concept of a woman needing to cover the hair. A married woman needing to cover the hair. The only issue is, and this is the whole halachic issue today, about women not covering their, yes, covering their, the leaning, where's the heter for it, where's not the heter for it. So basically, to discuss it for a few minutes, is as follows. There's, in the, so to speak, address of women, there's two aspects. There's what's called erva, nakedness, and there is tzniut, modesty. Okay? These are two distinct things. By the way, it also applies to men. There's erva by man, and tzniut by man. Okay? But more so to speak, by a woman, there's a concept of tzniut, and there's erva, nakedness. Certain parts of a woman's body are considered nakedness. Anything which is nakedness is irrelevant what the custom of the time and place is. Tzniut is relevant to time and place. Like, for instance, technically, and just saying the halacha, above the elbow, by a woman, this by a woman, not by a man so much, is called erva, nakedness. Okay? Therefore, even if everybody goes sleeveless, let's say, according to halacha, you can't go sleeveless, because that's nakedness. Nakedness doesn't matter what everybody's doing. But what happens, let's say, if you live in a certain area where everybody, all the women, wear their sleeves until the wrist. Now we know you only need to wear until to cover the elbow. What happens if you live in a place, for whatever reason it is, all the women wear until the wrist? That's tzniut. That's relative to time and place. If you live in a place that everybody wears sleeves until there, you have to do it. Not that it's nakedness, because from here to here is not nakedness. Right until the elbow. Above the elbow, above the knees, I mean all that, that's a din of nakedness, not a din of erva. So now, there's an expression in the Gemara, sar bi'isha erva. Gemara has an expression, the hair of a woman is nakedness. That's what the Gemara's expression is. And where do we learn it out from? From Saita. But the Gemara's expression is, the hair of a woman is erva. So now, there's two opinions in halacha. Some opinions say that the Gemara doesn't mean it's erva. The Gemara means really a din tzniut. That means, in a place where everybody covers the hair, then you must cover the hair. But if you live in a world that most women don't cover the hair, i.e. today, okay, so then it doesn't matter. That's the heter for those women that, you know, call themselves Orthodox, whatever, and don't cover the hair. Because they say it's a din in tznius, it's not a din in erva. The Tzemach Tzedek and a lot of other poskim write, no, it's a din in erva, in nakedness, and therefore it's totally irrelevant to time and place. But the original source of this whole covering the hair stuff is in this pasuk that we just learned. Uparas reisha isha. That's where it comes.
What's the difference between Sephardim and Ashkenazim? Where do they get their source from? That Sephardim usually want to cover it and not have a sheitel, but Ashkenazim.
Oh, that's a sheitel. I just read a story online. Is this the story online? You know, in Eretz Yisrael, the Torah Katniks, if we're forced into Sephardim, the Torah Katniks are completely anti-sheitel. You know, they bald the head, and that's why they bald the head, by the way, because any hair of a woman is nakedness. So if you bald, mamish bald it, you know, so then there's no problem.
Those are those that argue that if you put hair over hair, you're not really following because you're still making yourself beautiful. They wear smooth.
One second. No, so they bald the head and they only wear tichels, you know, the thing going, okay. There's a story in there, it just happened. A woman was walking in Geula, section of Yerushalayim, and the wind blew off a sheitel from Lady. The wind blew off a sheitel, which is a terrible embarrassment anyway, I mean, you know, for a woman. And she was chasing, she was running after the sheitel. The wind was blowing and she was chasing after it. A bunch of these Naturakata guys that are against sheitelach, so this is a great opportunity to get the sheitel away from her. So they ran quicker than her, and they grabbed the sheitel and they ran. This is what happened. The pearl, there was a Chabad guy on a motorcycle. I just read Mamish today. A Chabad guy was on a motorcycle. He caught up, he chased the guys. The woman kept running. She probably, in fact, that she ran home. I mean, she was so embarrassed. She just, but the guy chased these guys. And other, you know, other guys helped him. And they cornered the guy. The guy dropped the sheitel and ran. Now this Chabad guy is stuck with a sheitel that's ownerless. I mean, he doesn't know. He's trying to find out who owns it. See, there's two issues over here. There's one way of looking at it is that a woman should only look beautiful for her husband and for nobody else. Therefore, if a wig is going to make a woman look more attractive than her natural hair, it's wrong. Okay? It's wrong. Because a woman should look beautiful, she's attracting other men. Okay? Therefore, she should only look beautiful for her husband, and for everybody else, she should look ugly. Okay, that's their concept. The Rebbe was extremely adamant for wearing sheitlach. The Rebbe wanted Dafka to wear sheitel. And there's a few things. The Rebbe wrote in the Sicha, in the first years, the Rebbe writes, because in those days, the Rebbe writes, if you're walking in the street, nobody's going to take off your sheitel. I mean, you won't take off your sheitel if you see your friend. You might take off your tichel, you know, because you're embarrassed of your friend, but nobody's going to take off a sheitel. Sheitel covers the hair better than a tichel. The cloth. It covers the hair better. And the Rebbe Befeir said, women should wear sheitlach. In fact, one of the conditions, when years ago, at the beginning, that the Rebbe would be Mesad the Kedushin, the Rebbe officiated weddings on the conditions the girl wore a sheitel. And you have to understand, it's not today's sheitlach. It's only 1950. The sheitlach were not really nice. Now you have natural hair and the gorgeous and the nicer than the regular hair, you know. But in those years, sheitels weren't so nice. You know, it was very noticeable you wearing a sheitel. And the condition that the Rebbe would officiate the wedding was that the woman promised to wear a sheitel. Not, I'm not talking about covering the hair. Dafka sheitel.
To fit in.
That was what?
My wife has a sale on sheitels right now. And especially anybody in this class, it's even a bigger discount.
Sorry. If I buy one for myself, I get a discount?
I'd like to see you.
Your wife pays full price.
Can you wear it in the mikvah?
50% off.
A guy asked me the other day, Grad, he called me up, if he could wear a toupee instead of a yarmulke. He's in a place where it's hard for him to wear a kippah. He wants to know if he could wear a toupee.
And the answer is yes or no?
The answer is, as far as covering the head, it's good. The question is, will people think he's not wearing a yarmulke? In other words, is he going to be giving a bad impression that people think, ah, oh, this guy doesn't wear a kippah? Marisai, yeah. As far as the head cover, it's a head cover. But
when you said the concept of erva, it does not deal
with time and place.
Time and place.
Right. It's not relative to anything.
It's not relative to time and place.
Right.
When these women that say that they don't have to wear to cover their hair because it's issue of modesty.
Right.
Because they said because the whole world.
The Jewish world, the Jewish
and non-Jewish, or
right,
or,
both.
But also the whole world is going naked and no.
And Ochanami, but I'm saying this. That's not the excuse, but that's what they do there.
I see, but there really up to here it's nakedness. So really, yep. So it is.
Correct.
And the damage is the below knee, just before knee. After knee,
right. Above the knee.
Above
them. Is nakedness.
Above
them. Right. But again, there's a din of erva, there's a din of tznius. There's two different things in halacha.
And here, with just the two bones,
the collarbone, that's a din in erva also. But
bringing her very close to the Kodesh Kodashim?
It was in the northern part. Exactly where was it? What's the Gemara say here? In the doorway of the courtyard it was, of the Mishkan it was. It wasn't next to the Holy of Holies, no. Because a woman wouldn't be allowed to go in there. The closest part that a woman would be allowed to go in the Beis Hamikdash, or in the Mishkan. Okay. Anyway, so let's see this pasuk again. Yud Ches, because we didn't finish it. V'hemin ha'kein ha'isha l'vnei Hashem. The kohen puts it before Hashem. Uparas reisha isha yonkav is a woman's head. V'nasa ha'kapeh, and he puts on her palm. Eis minchas hazikar and minchas kenois, this meal offering that she just made of remembrance of jealousy. And in the hands of the kohen should be may amarim amarim, this bitter water. Now Rashi says the water wasn't actually bitter, even though the Gemara says they put a bitter herb into the water. Okay, now this water was a mixture of water and earth from the Mishkan and water from the Mishkan, and they put a bitter herb into it, but it really didn't make the water bitter. Rashi says, why does the Torah call it bitter water? Because if she's guilty, the end result is bitter. Because she's going to die. So, this is Rashi says. Al shem seifam, based on the end. Okay, so this is what she does. She comes to the Kohen, and she has this flower offering in his hand. In her hand, the Kohen has the water. And the Kohen gives her an oath. And he says to the Isha like this, if a man did not lay with you, and if you did not stray to become defiled under your husband, meaning while your husband stole your husband, if you're innocent, hinaki, you will be innocent. You will be innocent by the proven waters, by these bitter waters. Now the Kohen says, listen, lady, you're going to drink this water. Okay? You're innocent. It's going to be great. You're guilty. You're going to die. Admit your guilt. In fact, the Gemara in Sait also says, the Kohen would give actually the whole long lecture. The Kohen would say, listen, we can understand you did something wrong. A lot of people did something wrong. Reuven did something wrong. He admitted his guilt. Yehuda did something wrong. He admitted his guilt. This guy did something wrong. The Kohen begs her because they don't want to erase the name of Hashem. Like we'll soon learn, they write this whole parsha with Hashem's name on it with erasable ink, and they put the parchment in the water to erase the ink, and now she's drinking that water. Which, by the way, as the Gemara says, is a remarkable lesson that we know, that the Torah says, Hashem says, I would prefer erasing my name, in order to make peace between a husband and a wife. That's how important Shalom Bayis is, to make peace between a husband and wife. Because, you know, one of the gravest sins, so to speak, erase God's name, is like insulting Hashem. It's not important. Hashem says it's better to erase my name in order to make peace between husband and wife. And therefore, like you hear in all the Shalom Bayis classes, you can't fight over religion. Because religion, Hashem says, erase my name in order to make peace. So you can't fight over Yiddishkeit. Obviously, has nothing that you learned many times. Has nothing to do with Yiddishkeit. It's a good reason to fight. I mean, it's a good excuse to justify and make holy your fighting. Because now you say, see, I'm a zealot. This is all for God. It's nothing to do with me. I'm fighting for God. God said, don't fight for me. Take my name, erase it, just make peace between husband and wife. And that's also learned out from a site over here. All these things are derived one thing from the nether. So the site really, even though it's like, in fact, the Gemara also says at the end of Seita, that this only worked when adultery was not rampant. Once adultery, there was a lot of menafim, there was a lot of adultery, the Seita waters didn't work anymore. And it was a supernatural power that the waters had only worked when Jews behaved, and there are a few exceptions. But when most people didn't behave, the water didn't work. Okay.